Hello and welcome to the Das Nostalgia Podcast, Episode 7. As usual, I'm your host, Anatoly, and today, for your listening pleasure, I have another wonderful and very special guest with me tonight. How are you tonight, sir?
Hi, Anatoly. My name is Chris Lapine, or Artful Gamer on Twitter, and I am doing fantastic.
Oh, fabulous. So, dear sir, what are we going to talk about today?
We talked about the idea of where did we start off as kids, you know, pirating games, moving on to, you know, getting older and being able to afford to buy them, and then at some point in my life starting to collect them. So I guess we're talking about acquiring games in all their forms.
That sounds like a very interesting topic, at least for myself as an appreciator of DOS games. But before I guess we go into that, I gotta ask you the same question I ask everybody who comes onto this show. Do you remember the first time you were in contact with the IBM PC, like compatible or clone?
Absolutely. I thought about that a couple of weeks ago, and the first one I played was on our home computer, but it wasn't true, because in about 1983 or 84, I played Microsoft Flight Simulator 1.0, the original Sublogic version, mm-hmm. on an IBM. It could have been an XT or an AT. I'm not really sure which. It was in, you know, the old school with a monochrome monitor. And it took me a long time to dredge up that memory, because I would have been about 3 or 4 years old, four or 5 years old, actually. And I was in grade one, and my mother, long story short, she worked at an adult education center down the street from my school, mm-hmm. and I would go there after school and visit with her and basically just spend the whole afternoon with her. And they had this computer set up there, and I had no idea what a computer was. The whole idea of it didn't make any sense to me when I was five. And one of the adults that was getting taught there, I can't remember what his name was, but he loaded up Microsoft Flight Sim on this old XT or AT, and it was amazing. Nice. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever saw. And even though it was basically, you know, just a bunch of black and white you know, instruments, yep. With a barely visible, you know, heads up display kind of setup. Mm. I was just blown away by it. And me and my sister spent, you know, hours trying to figure out how the hell to play this thing. And it wasn't even really a game. You know, the most you could do is hold down the plus key and speed up a little bit, and you'd see the runway kind of shift a little bit and the instrument indicators change. But, that idea just blew my mind when I was a kid. I was just like, I'm doing something on the keyboard, and I was really, really young. I'm doing something on the keyboard, and it's making something on the screen change, and I get some small amount of control over that, and that was really cool.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I came back to that game. I wrote an article for my website a year or two ago, comparing Flight Sims, and I went back to Microsoft Flight Sim 1.0, and it is utter shit. It is absolutely awful. I mean, I get that it has come to, you know, influence, you know,
right.
The wide range of games, but I mean, it's uncontrollable. You can't do anything, and I'm sure like people must have had fun with it or did something. But it was about as much fun as, you know, like playing with a Microsoft Excel database. It was just terrible.
We have come a long way since. How long, like, from this point onto, like, maybe having a machine of your own or having an access to one machine and, you know, actually starting getting hold of, you know, different games?
Right. I would say I only had access to that machine for a few months. Mm-hmm. And then my mother moved on to another job, and we didn't have a computer at home. And they got us a Tandy TRS-80, and that was kind of, it was not a DOS machine, so I won't go into any amount of detail about it, but that was kind of an late 70s, early 80s it was called the Coco 2.
Right.
And it was kind of a response to the Commodore 64 and all of the other available systems at the time. So we had that for a long time, like 8 or 9 years, actually. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until... maybe not 8 or 9 years, maybe 5 or 6 years. It wasn't until about 1989 that we actually got our first real machine, our first like actual, that machine was bought at a garage sale or something, but our first real MS-DOS 3.3 machine was bought at a furniture store in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada called The Brick. What happened was, computers in Western Canada at the time, computers, the, you know, at least in Alberta, bumfuck Alberta, there was, the whole idea of computers was just, nobody used them. And even in 1989, people didn't think computers were an important thing. At least from my perspective. So even finding a computer store was next to impossible. And apparently, this national chain called The Brick started carrying Amstrad PCs in about 88 and 89. It only happened for a year or two, and these were a UK-built machine that they had adapted to North America. Mm-hmm. So my first real home computer was an Amstrad PC 2086, 8 megahertz. And it had a VGA monitor, 256 color onboard graphics, which was, now that I think about it, pretty mind-blowing at the time for a 286 machine. And although, if I remember correctly, if you ran it in 256 mode, you'd get all the snow on the screen because the chip couldn't really handle running at that refresh rate. So games that were meant to run at high res did look like crap on the computer if I actually tried. But anyway, it only had 600, you know, the standard 640K of conventional memory. Mm-hmm. It didn't have any expanded or extended memory. So that's, when we got that computer, that was my first time acquiring games. What about you?
Well, as I explained on one of my previous podcasts, I lived in a country where piracy was the only way. So, mm-hmm. But you either copied it from a friend, from friends, or even if you went like to the store or something, and they happened to be selling PC games, they like in the early, especially in the very early 90s, it would be floppies where somebody printed the sticker on a dot matrix printer with like the name of the game and slap it on it. So you would be buying, you could either not pay for pirated games or you could actually pay for pirated games.
Wow.
But pirated games is all there was up until about 96. And even then people didn't really buy licensed, software of any kind, and they still don't actually. It's like a huge issue in Russia, like the torrent capital next to China or something or other.
If I understand correctly, there was kind of copyright laws kind of came in the mid-90s, and that
copyright law didn't exist. I mean, that's why the whole debacle with Tetris happened, Yeah, we had no really... in Soviet times, government owned everything, obviously. But in post-Soviet times, it was really unclear who owned what or regarding everything, not just sort of intellectual property.
Right.
So, yeah, it was quite an interesting time. But it paid off for me because I had access to insane amount of games without really having to pay for it. Like later, like in the CD times, it became harder because, you know, even pirated CDs cost a lot for like a poor Russian kid. And but that you couldn't copy of your friends for a while because, you know, so basically those were those big pirated companies, just pirated games. They translated like in record times, they badly translated games,
really?
And then they put them out instantly. Whoever, you know, like they took them from like a big, they got them either from Going Abroad or from like big pirate releases, like from one of the groups that dumped like ISOs and betas like before things, so they would translate it in a matter of like weeks and just duplicate as many CDs as they could, like thousands and thousands of them, and just push them out across the country.
So how did that, do you happen to know a little bit about how that worked? Because I'm curious, did they have a way of hex editing in dialogue, or how did the translations actually work?
It's everything. People were very technically inclined, but there's just people who just like, and they were varying quality. Some really, really good, some really, really bad, especially in the mid-90s where those companies got a lot of money. Sometimes it would like,
right.
The Full Throttle has a beautiful dub done by professional actors,
but
it's a pirate release. So it's Leisure Suit Larry 7. They're better than a lot of legitimate releases that came in later years in Russia, and yet they're pirate unofficial releases done by hobbyists, you know. They just like crack the game, write all the decompilers that they need for scripts and everything, graphics editors, and then just bunch people, like three or four, you know, they just, would throw this together again and bam, it would be on the market.
That is really impressive. So how would you, okay, once these pirate releases were developed, how were they sold?
Physically.
So did they come on just basically a floppy with
well,
or CD?
Well, that's, we're talking
with,
the CD times.
Label?
Yeah, they would, yeah. Well, those things actually, again, since it was like the only way for a while, and
right.
Even later, it was like, sometimes it would be like, usually just a jewel case with, you know, a cover and a CD that was,
okay.
You know, like legitimately painted on, you know, like they were
right.
Done in the proper CD duplication facilities. So, they would be normal CDs. Some of them looked better than legit release. I had like a pirate, I've seen a really shitty pirate one CD rip towards later years of X-Files, the game. That 7 CD game, everybody just cut out all the QuickTime movies for chapters after the first, shoved it on one CD, but that jewel case was like all like the X was golden and embossed, and like it was like really
beautiful.
It was a beautiful box, beautiful CD. Obviously it's unplayable with all the QuickTime movies cut out of it, so there's that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess, and that's something we can talk about in a little bit, was, Part of the move in piracy, especially towards the mid '90s, when CDs became a thing, was releasing rips, right? And
full rips, or partial
you'd be
rips.
Missing tons and tons of things like dialogue, and you know the NFO would talk about what was stripped out. But I guess we're getting ahead of ourselves. Before I got into the actual legit piracy scene, and I guess we'll come back to that. My first experience actually pirating something was when I was about 14 years old, 13 or 14. The computer, the 286 I had, I managed to get it onto a BBS, a local bulletin board system. And for anybody who's not familiar with BBSs, I'm pretty sure everybody will be, given the nature of your podcast, was this idea that you could dial in to somebody else's computer, and that would give you access to message boards, file areas. I'm not sure if you spent a lot of time with BBSs.
I have, because again, my country is like 50 years behind on technology. So I actually think I still have a BBS phone number list file on one of my hard drive backups that I used to dial. And I think the last update I did to it, I shit you not, is from like 2002 or maybe 2001.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Our BBS is here. Basically all disappeared in 1997. They just all disappeared.
Right. Well, we also had like big, you know, FidoNet explosion in the 90s, so it attributed to them sticking around for a bit longer.
Okay, that makes sense. And I'm guessing the internet infrastructure didn't become more of a reality until later.
Yes.
I had a bit of okay, so I guess I'll go back to my thread. What happened was I dialed up. I did not understand what the idea of a modem was, but I was tinkering around with it, and somebody gave me, I think it was my computer teacher in grade 7 or grade 8, gave me a list of phone numbers, and he said, if you figure out how to dial up to these with your computer, you can get onto these really cool message boards. And I was just blown away by this idea. I just thought,
nice.
The whole
teacher.
Idea of my,
holy shit.
Oh yeah, he was cool. He gave me a bunch of shareware BBSs to dial up to. And I figured it out somehow, and I called in, and sure enough, yeah, you get this little, at the time it was a black and white interface because I didn't have a proper terminal client. And I could send commands to a machine that existed. I lived on a farm at this time outside of Edmonton, so that was about 60 kilometers away. So the idea of like me connecting to a computer 60 kilometers away and typing instructions into it and having it send information back to me just blew my fucking mind.
Right,
like I
right.
thought it was the yeah. I don't know what your first experience was, but for me that was just oh man, I want to do this all day, every day. So
yeah, no, mine wasn't too far off from that one.
So I once I kind of figured out what the whole purpose of this thing was, I immediately like instantly figured out, I'm like, the file areas, there's got to be something cool in the file areas. And at that time there was just a bunch of shareware, which was cool. I was finding stuff like Scunny Cart, I think.
Oh god, and dear lord.
I haven't even said that word in 20 years. Wow. Scunny Cart and what was Apogee's competing
Wacky Wheels.
Wacky Wheels, yeah, which was fantastic. And there were a bunch of those shareware games that were just kind of floating around, and people would upload these shareware games to the BBS,
right,
and
right.
they would get download credits for uploading something. And you know, the BBSs I connected to would give you some credits for, you know, some download credits for just connecting and creating a new user. So I had like 1 megabyte of credits to use, which meant on my 2400 baud modem.
Right.
I can't remember how fast that transmits at. It's really slow. I think it's under half a K a second. it's like unbearably slow, like 0.3 kilobytes per second. That meant like a 1 or 2 hour download for a 1 meg file. If you know, if there wasn't any
right.
line noise, and if somebody
no
didn't
carrier, like the side of horror.
Exactly.
Like, instant heart attack at that message.
Oh, it was like the worst. Or if at this time protocols didn't have error correction, I think it was Xmodem or something. So if somebody picked up the phone in the house,
yeah, that's it.
All of a sudden you'd see garbage all over your screen. You're like, what is that shit? You'd see a bunch of ASCII characters just spitting out, and you'd be like, Mom, put down the phone. and you know, your binary file's corrupted now, so you're screwed.
Yeah.
And so I figured out that I had a mag to use, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna make this good. And I, you know, I had already downloaded, you know, some of the shareware titles, which was pretty cool. I think I also grabbed maybe One Must Fall 2097 at that point. So yeah, long story short, I uploaded, I had 1 meg of credit. I had got enough to get, like, uploaded something to get 1.5 megs of credit. And I dug around in the file area, and they just had this one file. It was unnamed. It was just there was no, like, text description. And the file just said something like, tim.zip. And I was like, I'm betting the whole fucking bank on that. I have no idea what it is, but I bet you it's cool.
Right.
And
oh,
and
I know where this is going. This sounds amazing.
So I you know, I spent 2 hours downloading this file in the middle of the night. You know, it's 1:30 in the morning. I've got school. I'm in grade 7. It's 1:30 in the morning. I'm supposed to get up in a few hours, but I stayed up all night to watch the download come in. And I get it, unzip it, and I type tim.exe, and I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to get a virus or what, but I don't care. And, you know, I blew my whole load on 1 meg of game. And this game loaded up, and it had the Dynamics logo on it.
Right.
I'm like, what is this? Like a demo for like a Sierra game or something? And I had a full version of the Incredible Machine.
Yes.
And I remember I kept looking around, looking for a button that says, you know, welcome, or waiting for it to end, saying, welcome to the demo, you know, thank you for playing Tim 1, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
And it just kept going and going and going, and I realized, oh my god, I've got a full game, and I downloaded it off of somebody else's computer. And I remember thinking I was like the most badass 13-year-old kid on earth. You know, I didn't even know that pirating was illegal. I just
right.
knew it was really cool. So I remember I put this, it fit on exactly one floppy.
Right.
And I remember I copied it to, at the time, oh, this is actually kind of weird too. At the time, all my friends had high density 1.44s,
right.
But I only had a low density diskette, so I had to figure out how to split this. Now we're getting into real pirating. I guess this
Fine.
First
here we go. We've all been there.
Really pirating something.
I assume at least people who actually will listen to this episode probably are not strangers to this.
I would hope so.
Hopefully, and if they are, this is like their exciting look into the wonderful world of piracy. This is like a crime show happening right now.
Exactly.
For those
and if I ever end up, you know, in prison someday, we can point to this exact moment.
You heard it here first, people.
You know, Jeff Tunnel's going to show up in my house. I knew it, you son of a bitch. I've always wanted to apologize to Jeff Tunnel for that, because it literally was my like gateway drug into software piracy was his, you know, his like crowning achievement in life. And the sad part is I never ended up buying a copy of it. I guess we'll get to collecting in a bit, but what I did was, I'm like, I have to prove to somebody that I did this. Like, this is so cool. And I figured out, I can't remember if I learned how to split zip files at that point, or if I learned how to just copy only certain files to disk one and certain files to disk two. But I remember I put it on two disks, two low density 3.5-inch disks. And we had like, you know, a stack of 10 of those, and they were so valuable at that point.
Right.
I remember, you know, thinking my mom just like giving me a look like, if you need to use one of these disks, it better be a good reason. You know, it's only for backing up she was in university at the time.
Right.
It's only for backing up my documents. But I put it on two disks, and I didn't put a label on them. So I knew I could come back home and format them and pretend I hadn't used them. And I took them to school. Yeah. Oh yeah. It was totally like, if this goes south, I don't want to have to like peel a label off.
Right.
So, I took them to school, and I remember being on the bus and just being like, I don't know if you remember like being a 10-year-old kid or 12-year-old kid, your heart's just racing because you're so excited to do something.
Yep.
And I remember sitting on the bus, and it was an hour and a half bus ride to school, because we, like I said, we lived in a very remote area, rural area, and getting to school, seeing my buddies, I'm like, guys, like, I got a copy of this game, and I downloaded it off I don't think I used the word download, but I got it off another computer, and I tried to explain, you know, this cool story of me, you know, like hacking the Gibson basically and, you know, getting this sweet game, and here it is, you know, I didn't even pay for it.
Right.
And I'll never forget it. This was like this moment where my like whole life felt like it fell apart. I remember my buddies looking at me, and they were like just this blank stare, and they're like, anyway, so you guys want to like go play basketball or something? They had no idea what I was talking about, and that was the end of grade 7, if I remember correctly, and it was the first moment that I realized I think I might be the only person other than our computer teacher with a computer at home.
Right.
Nobody had computers, and I just also realized I can't trade games with people. And I was like, oh man, this sucks. I can't like talk about my cool, you know, nerding out with anybody, because they're all, you know, these guys are like normal, well-adjusted hillbilly, you know, farmers.
Right.
They're not into computers.
Wow. That is interesting.
So that's the tale of, I'm sorry, Jeff Tunnel, for pirating the incredible machine. I'll give you $10 somehow.
That is so interesting. So, and so different too, because I grew up, again, I always make it a point to state that in my country, like in the early 90s, especially with the exception of like a ZX Sinclair knockoff, Spectrum knockoff, and the in 1992, in August, in the second half of 1992, we had an official deal, a Russian company made an official deal with one of the Taiwanese unnamed companies to import Famicom knockoffs.
Oh, interesting.
And like tons of cartridges.
Oh, so did most of the computers manufactured at the time come from Taiwan?
No. Just the Famicom clones.
We officially
sold and advertised on television and had a TV show about it and all kinds of stuff and magazines and everything. We have sold a Famicom knockoff as a real thing for years and years and years. There's a great, a few years ago, there's this great YouTube feature documentary about it, AVGN style, but very good, done by a Russian. It's subtitled in English. It's called The Curse of a Gray Elephant. So anybody who is interested in should check it out. It's fucking fascinating for people who didn't grow up during those times. And I will show you how far behind we have been in technology and everything else. It's pretty amazing.
That sounds amazing.
The leading gaming platform was basically the PC.
Okay.
Everybody was familiar with PC gaming because everybody played games at work, basically, anytime they could. And not a lot of people had PCs for a while, especially through the 90s. But, people who did have PCs always used to, accommodate, three or more children on the nightly basis at the same time, because, we would go to other friends to play PC games, even if we didn't have PCs ourselves a while. So whoever had one was always had to, deal with their children's friends coming over to play this and that and the other. But I pirated games only. I never pirated a game on the BBS. I must say, I downloaded games off BBS, but I never did. Never really came to my mind. But I pirated games for my friends and stuff like that. So I had this whole special folder of utilities. Utility programs. It was in my path, so I can call it exactly certain programs to zero the files out. You'd just do mask and it was just instantly zero those files, so you can just cut out a bunch of cutscenes. A program that would lower the bitrate of WAV files, so you can just mass convert everything. I had empty smacker files and stuff like that, so you can I can copy them into smacker encoded cutscenes of old games, so I can just copy them for my friends. It's basically I would replace any cutscene with a second of black screen, which was a minimal size of the file, and that way it wouldn't crash because it would actually call the smacker player, but it would just it would be just no cutscene, but it wouldn't crash, it wouldn't not file not found. And of course I had one of the first DOS CD emulators that would create a drive, a CD drive that would load it, I think an MSCDX from a folder that I'm pretty sure you could assign a label to. Or maybe you had had to change the label of your C drive, and then somehow would trick. The details now escape me, but
for some reason I remember there being a command called it was, and it used basically the DOS subst command to mask or emulate a CD drive, and I can't remember. It wasn't called CD EMU; it was something else.
No, something else.
But I remember, almost every, half-decent pirate release I got made a use of that.
Mm-hmm. No, it was great. You would get, Command and Conquer like that and stuff like that, really chopped down, I think. One of those, you just, some of them, you just, ran a batch file, and they would do that just, in the beginning of the batch file. It's crazy how those things worked. And we copied them. I remember copying, this is not DOS, but I remember copying Worms 2 on floppies for some reason. I was pretty late at that. And I think it took me after I cut everything out, but left, I didn't want to cut out any landscapes, you know what I'm saying? Cause it's Worms, so you don't want to actually, cause they're different files. You can just take them out and game works without them. Because they're you can do custom ones and stuff like this, and they sort of counted for add-ons and stuff like that. But I wanted to keep those and take out everything. And I remember copying everything, 22 floppies with the last hours. It was just going to be a gigantic CRC file, check file, just to be sure that this is not fucked up in any way, shape, or form. Because copying 22 floppies is not fun.
That reminds me of this is fast forwarding. I guess it would be around the same time, around 1995 or something, 96. At the time, I was 15 years old, and I got my first real job. First official adult job, I would guess.
Right.
Working at the there's a section of Canada called the Northwest Territories, for anybody who's not too familiar with the geography. It's basically our Arctic. And I worked up there at the Arctic's first ISP. And as a 15-year-old, you know, working in an ISP just was like, it was heaven. Like, I was like around computers 24 hours a day. And one of my jobs was to, I basically did hardware for this company as well as phone support, tech support. And, because they also did, they also sold Gateway 2000 computers at the time. So kind of combination hardware dealer and ISP called SSI Micro. If Jeff Phillip, you ever hear this, I'm so sorry for what I'm about to say. one of the things we did was customers would order in, games, because this is, and I think there's probably something fairly comparable with growing up in Russia. In the Arctic, in the Northwest Territories at the time, the transportation and communication between the rest of Canada was almost nil. It was 14-hour drive to the next nearest city. So, you know, the idea of buying software from Edmonton way down south was unimaginable for most people. You couldn't pay FedEx to drive, you know, 14 hours to bring you your stuff. So Jeff, SSI Micro acted as this distribution center for software, hardware, and ISP stuff. And customers would order in, they would browse our catalog and order in, they would order in games through us, through our little corporate catalog. And then we would order them from our distributor, and we'd get them, you know, like 18 weeks later.
Right.
You know, because they'd have to go from Broderbund to, you know, to our distributor in Toronto, and Toronto to Edmonton, and Edmonton to Fort Providence, Northwest Territories. And, you know, and forever later they would get it. And the policy was, if we have the client's computer, we always install the game as a courtesy onto their computer for them, and then we ship them back their computer. And more often than not, we'd have a client's computer in, and we'd say, hey, you know what? Your game just came in. Do you want us to install your game? Well, hopefully you can kind of anticipate where I'm going with
this. Yes, I can. I'm waiting for this. Yes, do it. Go for it. Go for it.
So, you know, 15-year-old me had access to hundreds of floppy
disks. That sounds amazing.
It was amazing. I would crack, you know, the shrink wrap on these brand new games, which I would never be able to afford myself.
Right.
And, you know, I would get access to stuff that I would never, you know, in a million years imagine buying for myself. But right. I would sit there and laboriously, I had one computer on the shelf, on a rack, devoted purely to pirating games myself. It was like this old Gateway 386 or 486 that, you know, had a broken hard drive or something, but it was really good copying floppies. So I just would sit there, I'd unshrink wrap this person's game, install it on their computer, and then the second that disc came out of their computer, it would go straight into my copying machine. And I would be making, you know, five or six copies of the same game. And we, my coworker, I'll incriminate somebody. I'll just use his first name, Mac. He was this great Polish guy who's like an older brother to me at the time because I was just a kid. Mac, who was totally into, you know, Eastern Europe at the time. He was fresh out of Poland. Eastern Europe at the time was also having some of the same problems with getting acquiring software. He'd be like, hey man, did you make my copy? I'm like, oh yeah, here it is. And so we developed like this little kind of internal software piracy back and forth, depending who was working at the workbench that day.
That's great.
Out of curiosity, did you have a lot of luck kind of trading or swapping or copying floppies between friends?
I mean, I did, yeah, in the early days, that's all there was. So it's like, and people at work, you know, people bring game to work, from the employees copy that game to their homes and to give it to other people, just in general. It's like people would really just like be like, oh, what do you, like, you know, the two friends would meet, right? Like, what do you have at work? And they'll be like, well, I got like, you know, what everybody had at that time, like Prince of Persia, Leisure Suit Larry, like those are like standard games installed like on about every computer. And somebody was like, oh, I got like, I don't know, something, I don't know, King's Bounty. And people are like, oh, I don't have that. Like, if I give you a floppy, will you copy it for me? Like, sure. So that person goes to work, copies the game from work, eventually meets with that friend, gives them their floppy back, and that's how you go. So that's how games really floated around Russia in the early 90s. That was like, that was like 90% of all the game trade. That's how it happened. It's pretty crazy.
That's amazing. Yeah, we didn't really have a good Moxon Telegraph kind of system set up here because, forgive the very Canadian phrasing. We didn't swap, at least in my circles, we didn't swap a lot of floppies like that because not very many people had computers in the mid 90s. I mean, even until about 1995, I remember less than half the people that I knew had a computer in their home. And, our computer lab in school was still, this would be grade 10 for me or so. Our computer lab was still these beat up Apple IIe's. Mm-hmm. And I think we also had some really, I think they were called Mac LCs. They were these really crappy, low budget Macintoshes. But our school wasn't into IBM's, and I was just trying to think, in terms of copying, did I have any friends that I actively traded games with? I think in my case, I think I had a handful of people. I came from a tiny farm school. I had a handful of people, maybe like three or four people I knew in the entire school that had games, and would be willing to trade discs. But what we would do, and this is stupid now in retrospect, what we would do is actually just trade the diskettes. We didn't even make copies. So more often than not, I would trade away. This happened with my copy of Ghostbusters too. Fuck, I want it back. I just realized it's like, yeah, I've got an empty Ghostbusters 2 box sitting in my collection because I traded that game to some other kid who traded me his diskettes, and I can't remember what they were. He got Ghostbusters 2, and I got something else. And, you know, you never get them back because, you know, okay, can I tell a story that's not mine?
Yeah, go ahead. I welcome all the stories. This is like a story podcast. This is awesome. I'm having so much fun.
Oh, great. Okay, so this is a story about a friend of mine, two friends of mine, named Andrew and Wayne. And this has become a 25-year-long grudge, and I'm not joking. This still continues today. They don't speak with each other. In grade 9 or so, two of my buddies, Wayne and Andrew, had computers, grade 9, grade 10. Maybe it's closer to grade 10. They did have IBMs at home. And that was a big deal for me because I was like, oh, finally, I got some people I can trade games with. They had worked out a trade with each other for Dune 2, which is like a
holy grail.
Oh, he was the only guy in the school that had that game.
How did that happen?
It was just like, I hadn't even heard of the Dune series, the game series, until I saw that game, and I was just like, "This is amazing!" I hadn't played anything even remotely close to an RTS. My buddy Wayne and my buddy Andrew make a swap: Dune 2 for I can't remember what game. It might have been Wing Commander 2 or something like that. Wayne gets Wing Commander 2, Andrew gets Dune 2. Pretty reasonable deal, in my opinion. Yeah. And Wayne gave Andrew the floppies and the manual for Dune 2, and Andrew just gave Wayne the floppies for Wing Commander 2, but no manual or anything like that. And no big deal. 6 months pass, Andrew's long since finished Dune 2, and they get into a scuffle of some kind at school. I can't remember what it was about, but Wayne showed up at Andrew's house and said, "Hey, man, I want my Dune 2 back."
Right.
And Andrew's like, "I don't know what you're talking about, man." And Wayne's like, "Are you kidding me? Give me my fucking game back!" And there was just like this altercation in my friends group. This was like such a big deal. There was this altercation over this game, and Andrew disappears, and forgive me, Andrew, you probably do listen to this podcast, but I do have to tell the story. Andrew came back with a baseball bat.
Oh, man.
And was like, kind of like threatening Wayne with this baseball, like, get out of my house before, you know, I beat the shit out of you. And Wayne laughed, and this started this terrible enmity between the two. Wayne never got his game back. and and it was all over this Dune 2 manual. I just remember it was the Dune 2 manual. He wanted it back. And, you know, this went on for 3 years, didn't talk to each other. And this was a really small school. It had like 300 students. So, you know, one person not talking to another was a big deal. And it happened. We all went to high school, went to university. We went on moving on into careers. And 3 years ago, we all get together for a beer. And I was like, hey, I should call up Andrew. And you know, it's been 15 years since high school or something. And Wayne just looks at me. He's like, nah, man, don't do that. I'm like, what? like, why? And I'm like, he's like, fuck that guy. I'm
oh,
like,
oh, man.
Are you serious? And he's like, yeah, man, I didn't get that fucking manual back, and that guy is an asshole for life.
Holy shit.
It's been 15 years. So I was like, oh, this is outrageous. Like, come on, stop being so petty. And I'm like, it's just a game. So long story short, I call Andrew a few days later and say, hey, you know, we should get together for a beer sometime. And so he comes over and we have a beer and goofing off in the bar talking about old games. And Dune 2 comes up. And Andrew's like, I don't want to talk about that. And I'm like, oh, come on. I'm like, it's been 15 years. What happened to Wayne's Dune 2 manual? Like, did you keep it? Do you still have it? Like, maybe you can give it back to Wayne.
Right.
And you know, it's fix this like ongoing feud. Like, it's a blood feud at this point.
Right.
And he looks at me. I swear to God. And he looks at me, just like has his beer in his hand. He goes, I burned it.
That's hilarious.
And he set fire to his manual and burned it page by page in high school. And that was the end of the story. And to this day, if Wayne doesn't know that, I know Wayne doesn't listen to this podcast, but if he ever found out, that would be nuclear war.
Oh, man. Don't so, tell yeah, Wayne anybody. You
know, trading and pirating was a big deal.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, man. Those are excellent stories, sir.
It's not mine. Like I said, I'm just telling it as a third party.
It's still good.
I thought it was it's pretty great that, yeah, 15 or 20 years worth of hatred over pirating a copy of Dune 2.
Yeah, I didn't really have any drama. I just happened to, like, the most drama I had, like, I sort of like made, I mean, like on CDs maybe, just like, you know, that's when you like try to trade, maybe that's when trading was more popular, and you know, that's like you like swapped out, because at least right. On floppies you could always like copy it, you know, to yourself and whatever, have it on your hard drive. Like CDs, usually games are big, you couldn't copy them at that time, so like swapping a game for like a worse game, you like a plate, and you're like, oh, this is not as fun, and you're like, oh, well, now I'm screwed because I lost a better game.
Yeah, it was tough figuring out, you know, what's worth trading for, what's worth copying, what's worth, you know, pirating. I was trying to think if I have any other, you know, really good experiences. Oh, I have one more story, and I've told this one to you, I think, before, but I might as well repeat it since it all happened in grade 6, grade 7. This is kind of like, this is my first experience actually trading a game with somebody else. My friend had Police Quest 2, and I'm doing this all backwards. In grade 7, grade 6 or grade 7, I bought my first game with my own money, which was a big deal. I went up north and I worked all summer for $3 an hour or $1.50 an hour. I can't remember what I was making at that point. It was not a lot of money, and I'm pretty sure it was around $3. Right. At a grocery store as a stock kid. And I worked for 2 months, and I made, I think, $150. Like, it wasn't a lot of money. I was working, you know, like half of a day and then going home and playing on the computer.
Right.
But I had made about $150. And I remember to this day going to Radio Shack, at the end of the summer and buying a copy of Space Quest 3. It was the first game I had ever bought with my own money, and it was the coolest experience ever.
Yes.
So it was a lot of money. I spent $80, which, you know, for a 10 or 11 or 12 year old was just like an astronomical amount of money. So yeah, I remember buying it, installing it, playing the shit out of it on a Tandy 1000 nice. At that point for, you know, for like months because I couldn't finish the game. But this is how it leads to the story. Oh yeah, and thank you, Scott Murphy, for getting me crack addicted to games. That was basically my gateway drug. I had this game and I spent a lot of money and I was very proud of buying it. And this kid at school, Carl Welischuk, may you ever forever burn in hell for doing this to me. I can get out all of my high school hatreds now. in grade 7, we decided to swap games, grade 6, grade 7, sometime around there. He had a copy of Police Quest 2, and he gave me the discs for PQ2, and I gave him my Space Quest 3. I gave him everything, just to keep that clear. I gave him everything. Right. I gave him the box. I gave him the diskettes. I gave him the manual, everything.
Right.
And I only got the discs in return, which I didn't think was a big deal, except...
Until, most yes.
People, yeah. Most people remember the terrible copy protection that came with Police Quest 2, which was, you know, here's a picture of some sort of criminal, and you need to look up the corresponding description in the Sierra manual for the game.
And type in the name.
I install the game, run into the copy protection issue, and I'm like, oh crap! I need to get the manual. So I called Carl, which was long distance. I got to make that clear. He lived, even though he only lived about 10-15 miles away from me, it was still long distance. So I would call him in secret and be like, Carl, I need the manual. I wasn't allowed to call long distance from our house because it was like outrageously expensive, like $2 a minute to call long distance somewhere. And I was like, I need the manual for Police Quest. He's like, I'm not giving it to you. And I'm like, what? He's like, no, you can just call me every time you need to get the copy protection, and I'll give you the copy protection number. So just describe to me what he looks like. So, you know, I would be looking at the computer. And I'd be like, okay, he's got like black hair and a mean mustache and blue eyes. And he'd be like, he's like, oh, that's Jesse Baines. You know, and this would take like 5 minutes because right. I would get it wrong sometimes. Sometimes I get it right. And you know, so this went on every day for a whole month.
Oh, God. And until.
Yeah.
Until, all your stories have those wonderful until moments. I'm really enjoying this.
I guess I was a pretty dumb kid when I was a kid, or I thought I could get away with a lot or something. I thought I was totally getting away with this. You know, I'd call for 5 minutes and right after school, and he'd give me the number, and I'd play Police Quest all night. I'd leave the computer running the whole night. I wouldn't let my sister touch it, you know, because if she exited, I'd have to call Carl back. So I played for a whole month until my mom and dad called me into the kitchen, and they were like, can you explain this phone bill? And I'm like, I was confused. I was like, what do you mean? They're like, who's been calling 363-2161 or 363-2256? I didn't even try to deny it. I was like, that was me. They were like, why were you calling this number every day? I'm like, because Carl told me that, you know, he wouldn't give me the game manual. And as soon as they heard games, they were like, I knew it. It was games. Yeah. That kid's banned off the computer for 2 weeks. And I was just like, the whole idea of being off the computer for 2 weeks just killed me.
Yeah.
But I looked at the bill later, and it was something like $55 of phone calls to a place, you know, a few miles away.
Right.
And at that point, I all of a sudden realized I could have bought the whole frigging game
with
the same amount of money because I had to pay it back to my parents. That did not improve their view of video games. They were never strict about it. In fact, my mom was pretty awesome about getting games for us, but they definitely didn't see any sort of educational value in having games, that's for sure. My mom was actually the first person that got me into software piracy because when we got our first computer, the Tandy TRS-80 Coco 2, we couldn't afford a disk drive because they were outrageously expensive, like $700 or $800.
Right.
So we had cassette tapes, like, you know, I'm sure a lot of Speccy owners had. And my mother had copied dozens and dozens of games off of a friend who also had a Trash 80 on cassette. So we had these like great, you know, cassettes with hand-printed names for all of the games and how to load them properly and that kind of stuff. And that really stuck with me. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, we copy games at home all the time. What's the issue?
Yeah. That sounds familiar, only, you know, I didn't have any other option.
Yeah, exactly.
So BBSs and the internet, finally, eventually.
Out of curiosity, on the topic of acquiring games, and this would be legally, I guess that maybe that's a good segue unless you've got more stories. Did you ever do any basic type-in games? For anybody not familiar with them, were these books you could buy, or sometimes just get them in magazines, which would just have lists of basic code that would build you a game if you typed it all in laboriously over, you know, a series of days and months. And in my case, we had easy access to Radio Shack had basic programming books, and I can't remember the name of them. Hopefully somebody will point this out to me on Twitter. Radio Shack sold these basic books for like $6, and they would be like, build your own games in basic. And in our case, again, this is not DOS related, but definitely had to do with the way that I treated basic when I did get MS-DOS. Was to type in very laboriously these type-in games. And one tiny story, my mom, the first and last time she ever programmed a computer, Mom, I love you to death. I want to give you credit for this. You inspired me to become a game programmer. I said, Mom, I really want this speedboat game. This looks so cool. You know, and on the picture of the cover of the manual, it's like this picture of a red speedboat dodging shit on the right, on the river, right. And it looks rocks and logs everywhere. I'm like, damn, that's cool. You know, I'm gonna be that guy. And I'm like, Mom, could you do this for me? And I was in grade four at the time. And she's like, okay, you know, she had a job at a newspaper, and she would come home early sometimes, and she sat there for 4 days and typed in, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day, thousands and thousands of lines of code. I have to find this book somewhere someday, for this speedboat game. And I just remember that it was called Speedboat on the cover. And I remember I came home, and this is poor tiny Chris didn't understand how RAM works. I came home. She had just finished typing it in. She was like, here, your game's ready. And I was like, you know, oh, cool. I've been waiting all week for this. You know, thanks, Mom. And I sit down and I play it, and it's this piece of shit. ASCII-based, one frame per second. It's like, do, 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 do. Yes, you know, it's like this.
Right, right.
But one frame per second moving this at symbol left and right on the screen as like slash marks and asterisks come towards you. It was so bad. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is nothing like my other cool games I got on cassette tape and cartridge. What's the deal? Oh, this game sucks. And I remember reaching behind the computer, switching it off.
Oh, man.
I'm like, oh, Mom, that game wasn't very much fun. And she's like, oh, okay, well, I want to give it a try. And she walked over to the computer. She's like, the computer's off? I'm like, yeah, I turned it off. Remember, you told me to always turn off the computer so it doesn't wreck the TV. And her face just like went pale. And I'm like, what? She's like, well, I didn't save it to a cassette tape.
Oh, man.
My poor mom had labored, you know, for 14
right,
hours.
Right. Oh, man. Sick.
First and last programming experience for my mom, who's like, you know, the first coder I ever met in life. Right. And I feel so guilty to this day for doing that to her. So, you know, I've never once told her about that. I actually remember that story. So I'll hopefully she'll listen to the podcast sometime. Accept my apology. But yeah,
pretty amazing.
type-ins were cool for people who didn't have any money, because you could just photocopy them.
Right, right. No, those were never popular where I was, because we just pirated actual games.
Yeah, exactly. And let's be clear, they were total pieces of shit. So
yeah, of course.
I guess that's a segue for me, at least, into buying games and acquiring them in a very legal way. Yeah, we kind of jumped headfirst at some point into. I bought a lot of Sierra Adventure games, especially. Mm-hmm. King's Quest IV stuck out. I think it was the first game my family ever bought for the family. Even though, you know, at the time there were plenty of other games I had played, like I'd played King's Quest II at that point.
Right.
But we had actually bought a copy of King's Quest IV, and that was extremely cool to actually, you know, to actually install a game that we had purchased. It felt cool to say, wow, we have this. Nobody else has this game. We're the only people in, you know, 200-mile radius that actually own King's Quest IV. So yeah, that was a big deal for us. But like I said, piracy, you know, by that point, I was starting to learn that I could download stuff off of BBSs. So, you know, piracy was already, you know, rearing its ugly head.
Right.
And I guess I can be honest. I pirated way more than I ever purchased.
Of course, everybody did. Yeah. I mean, if you didn't, I guess, you know, I shouldn't say that. I guess quite a lot of people didn't. So if you didn't,
that's
please
right.
Let us know in the comments. Tell us your story. We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
Somebody, like, if you bought the games yourself, like you saved your money, or maybe you had parents that bought you like all the games ever, that would be sweet. You know, all that stuff. Yes, let us know.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting too, because I remember parents really turning a blind eye to this. I mean, I'm sure deep down parents knew that they probably shouldn't let their kids copy games. But I remember people just not caring. It was not
on anybody's mind. It was really that much in the public eye back then. Like, it wasn't really looked down on. It's like,
yeah.
like other crime, like, oh, it's like now it's like piracy is a crime. But back then it's like,
yeah.
Well, crime is like robbing a bank or killing somebody.
Exactly.
Copying
yeah,
a few floppies is like hardly a crime.
Yeah. Do you actually happen to recall the first time you ever saw an anti-piracy notice in a game?
In a game? Well, because there were like, well, I guess, yeah, I have seen them, but I never really paid attention to them. Again, growing up in a country with no copyright, you kind of tend to ignore. Like, I even seen, like, I think it was, is it Age of Empires? I think it's either Age of Empires, one of the pirate releases on the back. Like, they completely redone the cover, and, like, the text on the back of the case was humorous, and where it used to end. But it was all repainted, like, re-photoshopped original art.
Wow.
At the bottom where it's like all rights reserved in the corner, like they painted it out, and in Russian they wrote all rights I ignored. And yeah, so this is the kind of attitude that my country had towards copyrights, and probably still does, unfortunately. So I didn't really much pay much attention to those sort of things.
I seem to remember my first kind of first time I saw something in game, and that was actually with Doom. I remember getting a legal copy of Doom, and I'm trying to remember who. You know what? I think this might have been this may be the only person I've known my entire life that bought a copy of Doom from their 1-800 number. My boss of that internet ISP company, I think he did get a copy of Doom, and he bought it, and I remember he installed it with, you know, version 1.666 or whatever off the floppies. And for some reason, I remember when you quit the game, there's this flashing ANSI screen says, do not pirate this game, something to that effect. And I remember being, the first time I saw that, I was like, whoa, like, you know, kind of, what's up their ass? Like, people are going to pirate it. Like, really? Do you think that's going to, you know, that's going to work for anybody? And, you know, meanwhile, I'm sitting there copying, you know, a copy of Doom to separate floppies. But I do remember seeing that in game. That was the first time I personally saw it in game. And for some reason, I think Apogee's other games also tended to have
all the Apogee games had it.
Yeah, oh, okay. So it was all of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hadn't played their whole library until I was much older, and yeah, I remember seeing the ANSI color screen, you know, saying "Do not pirate this game."
It's either like that or in the game, but like for the shooters, like it did that, and like Rise of the Triad did that, so it's sort of like all the shooters did that sort of ASCII exit screen at the end.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, even as a kid, this is not gonna work, because, you know, first thing I'm gonna do is find a way to pirate this. You know, and at that point, those games didn't have copy protection anyway, but, I was just thinking of, speaking of copy protection, How did you get around copy protection with some of the titles that you played as pirate as a downloader or pirated yourself?
Well, most of them, if they weren't cracked, actually required some kind of a copy protection, like one of my pains of my existence is Space Quest IV.
Oh, okay.
Which had to have that copy protection in place because
it was in game, yeah.
It was in game, but like it couldn't be scripted around. Sometimes you would even people would even rewrite the scripts to just skip the copy protection parts altogether.
Right.
But that could not be the case with Space Quest IV. It's actually sort of, it's in the game. It's one of the most annoying types of copy protection ever is the one that's actually mixed into the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Usually there would be like some kind of a text file that if you were lucky enough to have an access to any printer of any sort, you would just print. Or if you didn't, pen and paper, and there you go, draw all the symbols and thing. But most of the games were cracked. Not that many games ever remember having to refer to a text file. I think it was like one that I had for Castle of Dr. Brain actually had a scanned page of those symbols in some kind of an ancient format, like a TIFF or something, but with the only 2-bit colors. It was only black and white, so it wouldn't be a huge file. So there was that once. Like, I remember that stands out to me. But most of the time, the games were just cracked. Something like Police Quest 2 would just, like, give you like partial just a list of names, and you would be like, well, I'm gonna guess it's this name, so you would punch in name number 6 and hope that it actually matches with the copy protection. Most of the releases were cracked long ago and cool. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I never really got into the cracking scene myself, and I guess we'll get to that in a little bit. I'll probably be careful about what I say. But I was more into, copying stuff by hand. I, for instance, had a copy of Out of This World. And I think, for me as a kid, pirating wasn't pirating because I was just like, I want to share this experience with somebody else. And the easiest way to do that is for me to make a copy for them or lend them my discs and give them the copy protection wheel. And I'm sure you remember very well the copy protection.
Yes, it's a great wheel.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's ingenious. Because it's not hard to, let's say it's not hard to understand. Like it's very quick to put the codes together.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's very laborious to copy the thing because he had definitely hand printed a lot of the symbols or all of the symbols. So, I was talking with, Brian on, Twitter, Demodulated, about, hand copying the symbols right off of the code wheel and then fashioning, cutting out this from a piece of paper and then fashioning the second layer code wheel that fit on top of it and cutting out all the right holes. and I have that somewhere in one of my boxes. I've got my little hand copy code, which I was so proud of. I think it took me 2 hours under a desk lamp to pull it off. But that was just because I wanted my buddy Rob to see how cool this game was. We didn't have cracks when I was in grade 7, grade 6, or I didn't have access to them. So, doing it the old-fashioned way worked. Out of curiosity, did you ever own a copy of SimCity, the original SimCity?
Oh, what, like physically? On like
another? Yeah, physically.
No,
yeah.
No. No, I never
have. Okay. Interestingly, because that one, they went with a number, kind of rows and columns, here under row J, or I can't remember what it was, something like that. But the trick was, it was a sheet of paper that was dark, 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 dark red, like a red brown.
So you couldn't photocopy it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was just like, I remember being blown away by that at the time because I had access to the school photocopier when I was a kid. And, the other way around copy protection manuals was just to photocopy the whole manual.
Right.
And I remember putting that in the Xerox machine at school and doing like 3 copies and all of them came out solid black. I'm like, oh my God, that's so brilliant. And I just, I remember that one. That one I also copied out by hand, and that one took me a few hours too. You know, again, and again, just for the sake of letting one or two friends even try the game out. So yeah, the copy protection was, you know, interesting in the DOS era for me, just because there was this schism between learning how to copy stuff myself at home, and then this crazy transition into the late 90s, which was cracking groups and really professional intros and outros for games,
right,
and, you know, really solid crackers being in the demo scene and cracking scene. And I made a transition into that kind of lifestyle at some point. I don't know if you were ever involved in this. Did you ever play around with IRC or Usenet?
No. I have played around, but I never really personally was involved in any sort of hacking and cracking. I just sort of reaped the fruit of other people's work.
Well, and I think that was 99% of people.
Pretty much, yes. I still are.
And I was one of them. I was definitely one of them up until, on IRC, I guess for anybody who wasn't actually a part of that, the whole leeching thing became a big deal in the late 90s. You know, it became possible now to massively copy files. Did you ever, out of curiosity, I don't know what your first internet experience was, did you ever dig around in public FTP sites for pirate folders?
I've never. No.
Oh,
that
okay.
That never really.
I guess it must have been quite easy for you to copy.
Yeah, exactly. And I also been on like kinds of FTPs where you just like go and there was some kind of a public FTP server, so you can just go into like all the user, every user is just open. It's just folders for each user, and you go in and you're like, hey, somebody uploaded, like, in one, you go in, like, something, like, there's some name or something, like,
right,
and then some other folder, you go in, like, five levels deep, and like, hey, look, there's somebody uploaded, like, a little big adventure, all in, like, 50 ARG archives, and there you go.
Exactly. That was what I was thinking of, was people burying, you know, DOS games, in public FTP servers. And for me, the big score was this, server in, I think it was the University of Washington, called wuarchive.wussel.edu. That's the way I always said it in my head, which was, I think, the, you know, Washington University State, their public FTP site. And they had, somebody would use like the period or the dot and be like dot private or dot where's, and they would hide files in a hidden folder in there. And if you knew the location of the folder, you could just type it into your FTP client, and you'd just be like overwhelmed by, you know, the number of, you know, fresh hot where's available, 0 day kind of stuff,
right,
in this
right.
Public FTP site. And, you know, as part of my, at that point, and this would be 1995, like early 1995, I was still very much in the DOS 622 mode at that point. And I dug around in this site and I found a copy of Windows 95 beta, which I don't know if you had a chance to check out the Win95 beta, but it was like, I don't know how many disks, like 25 or 30 disks, 1.44 meg disks, and I had to download each and every one of them over a 2400 baud modem. And I remember I spent weeks trying to get that, and at some point I got halfway through through like all 20 some odd disks, and the FTP owner must have figured out that this folder existed, and he deleted the damn folder. So I had half of Windows 95 beta at some point, all you know, laboriously copied to diskettes over a modem. But I guess back to games. I will admit that I got quite heavily involved in then, and this is a, I guess this is for your listeners, this is probably a bit of a gray zone.
You don't have to admit anything, honestly. You can be just like, I could be all making it all up.
So could
you. So I don't think anybody's
sure this story will sound very realistic. So I will fabricate a real life story on the spot.
Yes. Let's go for it.
I got very involved in, and this is a great gray area. We're getting into the whole idea of abandonware now. In the late 90s, you know, we were into the Windows, firmly into the Windows 95, 98 era, and DOS games were just, nobody played them. I just remember specifically thinking, like, nobody cares about this. They want stuff that plays, you know, in Windows. They don't want to have to shell out to DOS or reboot to DOS, even worse. And, you know, Fallout had already been out by this point.
Right.
And I remember thinking, I'm like, oh, that's such a shame. Like, why aren't people playing old DOS games? Like, they're the best. Like, they're clearly the most fun I've ever had with games. And so, remember, this is a fictional story.
Of course.
That
doesn't
have
to be fictional. It's just like, I don't think anybody's going to fact check a podcast or listen. If they listen to, you know, to this point, up to this point, this far, they're probably okay with it. I'd say.
Good point. And at this point, you're basically already an accomplice. So,
pretty much. We gave out that FTP address, didn't we?
That's right. Yeah, you were probably one of the people that downloaded Windows 95 beta. So I got involved in a little piracy group called Atlantis. And Atlantis's goal was, their charter was to release abandonware and the oldest possible stuff that we could find that we thought was cool. So if you were ever on Usenet in the old binaries group, alt.binaries.wares.ibm.pc.old.
Wow.
I still remember that to this day. I typed that in 1,000 times with my newsfeed client. We would play these, you know, kind of go to the old classics that everybody loved, like Prince of Persia, or I should actually like dig through my Atlantis folder here. I still have it. I kept nice. A CD with a, I kept a CD with like all of the old Atlantis releases because I was so proud of what we did. There it is. Cool. We would laboriously play the games, decide if they're of a decent quality, and then we would set up the games with the proper configuration files. The default was always Sound Blaster IRQ5 DMA1 address 220, and we would pre-install them, and then the last big step would be to crack them somehow, because, you know, 80% of these had some sort of copy protection.
Yep.
Yeah, and we weren't, you know, me and a person named Cathead and S Darkness was the other handle I just remembered. We would kind of spend our time trying to figure out how to do all of this stuff, and we didn't have anybody who knew how to hex edit, so we had to come up with kind of homemade solutions on how to release these games. You know, and most of these games were already 10, 15 years old at this point. One of the things we would do, and it was the best tool I had in my arsenal, but it probably made us look like we were really unprofessional, because, you know, real cracking groups had their own crackers.
Right.
We would use this program called Locksmith PC. I'm not sure if you ever ran across it.
It doesn't sound familiar, but how does it work?
Locksmith PC was really cool. It had this kind of Norton Commander interface to it. It was pretty professional. And what this company had done, and this program I think was like $100. It was outrageously expensive, but we of course found it a pirated copy of it.
Of course.
Ironically. It was like Serial Seeker, one of these, you know, kind of modern serial number programs. It would just give you this massive list of like 1,000 games or 2,000 or 3,000 games. And it would hunt down the EXE or COM file and crack it for you. And the only thing it would do would be, it would insert a Locksmith PC title page into the game. It would somehow kind of, you know, insert this into the load screen. So yes, completely illegal activities. We would crack these using Locksmith PC. To this day, I'm sure I have a copy of it somewhere, but I Googled for it a few days ago and it has disappeared off the web. and we would crack it with Locksmith, and then we would write up an NFO, and it would contain pretty specific instructions on how to play the game, and including any, like, you know, key codes you need, or in the case of Locksmith, if it just fully cracked it, we just say, you know, it's already cracked, just run and enjoy. And, you know, or here's the sound blaster settings you'll need, or that kind of thing. But we were enormously proud of the work that we went into this, because we would do things like scanning in, if we had to, for instance, like Star Trek, 25th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
There was no way of cracking that one, so we would scan in the manual, right, which was a star map, right? And so you could get to the various systems in the game. So, yeah, we were very proud of releasing. And it was once a week. We would post a new game to alt.binaries.wares.ibmpc.old. And we would upload it there. And I remember at some point we were like, that group, that Usenet group, was moderated by, can't remember this dude. I just remember we were like the premier old wares cracking group at that point. And this would be, again, yeah, 2000, 2001, 2002. Even getting into that, we released games for, I think, 4 or 5 years straight. And we would always kind of aim for the highest quality kind of pirate releases. But I really specifically remember thinking at that point that this is not piracy. We're doing a job to keep these games curated and still in existence, right, because otherwise they'll just disappear.
Yes, absolutely.
And at some point, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that website, Home of the Underdogs.
Oh, I'm very familiar with that website.
Yeah. We became obsolete as soon as HOTUD came around. I was just like, finally, there's a website for exactly this kind of stuff. Yeah. And that was
the Underdogs was one of the like few places you could get some really obscure shit at that time.
Exactly.
Like, one of my favorite sort of like very unknown titles is The Dark Eye, and the Underdogs for the longest time, Home of the Underdogs was the only place to get it, and it was the full thing. I just copied the folder of the root CD, so nothing was cut out. It was like a 500, one of the largest files on there for the longest time.
That's massive. I didn't realize it was on there.
Yeah, that was there. So I am very familiar with that website. It was like the abandonware website for quite a long time. Legendary.
Oh, no kidding. I remember, I don't think I even used the word abandonware for quite a while. I just remember thinking, this is what we should do. This is a moral, you know, this is the right thing to do. It's not the wrong thing to do.
Absolutely.
You know, because nobody's going to look after this stuff. And certainly not the companies. And it was only until very, very recently that, you know, all of a sudden companies realized they can make quite a bit of money off of, you know, re-releasing their old stuff on GOG or Steam.
I mean, thank God for GOG. Well, this is the thing. Like,
oh, absolutely.
I'm sure if people listen this far, they will, they're probably lenient towards it, at least somewhat, or understanding maybe. But it's like, my thing is like, think of what you will about piracy, but very unfortunately, and I'm stating this right in the DOS Nostalgia podcast, unfortunately, like IBM PC gaming, retro gaming, seems to be the least respected area of retro gaming, to the point of not being mentioned at all sometimes.
Absolutely.
Like, many people would attribute it probably correctly to the fact that the platform is not dead. So that would probably have a big factor in it. Yes, most people, even people into retro gaming, are sometimes not aware that, PC gaming, like, existed until recent years. it's really strange. To me,
I find that all the time with talking to friends, especially in person,
is baffling. And like they would know, like the 8-bit computers, right? They would be like, "Oh, if you're European, like, oh, it's Sinclair," or like here, it's like, "Oh, Commodore 64." But they will like completely ignore the fact that PC gaming existed.
It's hard to find. Can you imagine trying to explain to Electronic Arts, you know, please release your PC booter game on GOG or something
It's really difficult. But GOG is one thing, and thank God we now have service like that.
Oh, no kidding.
It's great. I love it. I love it so much. I give it all. Well, I don't personally give it most of my money, but like I know people who
shop there all the time, and like, and it's like I did actually rebuy some of the games that I own physically, just so I don't have to like install patches, and I'm lazy. That's how lazy I am. I go for like I go for like hacking Xenon 2 until like I'll just buy another copy of this game. I'll just throw the money at it so I don't have to. God forbid I spend 5 minutes installing patches. But the thing with this, I'll with all that. There are wonderful resources on the internet that which we will not name on this podcast, but you can probably use the search engine of your choice to find them rather easily, that preserve this. I mean, yeah, lately with GOG and everything, it's more in the public eye slightly, I guess, but still, a vast majority of those games,
have never heard of GOG.
Yes, and a lot of those games that are not unknown, like they're, it's a rather niche area, and if there is something that's unknown in the niche area, it's practically extinct. And thank God for those websites that maybe it's not exactly illegal. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah,
it's a preservation. I look at it as preservation of history. There are wonderful resources out there that, yes, pirate games, yes, pirate, a lot of games, technically, sometimes pirate games that are still being sold. You know, like it's one thing, I guess, to pirate game that's not being sold anymore for like 20 years. Right. And there's another thing that, that to pirate a game that is being sold currently, but they also pirate games that like have would have otherwise been lost. Like certain copies of some games are just available on those websites. They don't even exist physically anymore. And it's,
and more exactly, and more often than not, even the developers don't have them anymore.
All the
one
rights
thing I've
to
learned.
Put them out.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
a
or,
bigger
or,
issue.
Exactly.
Yeah. See, even if you have something, doesn't mean you actually have the right to legally put it out or the means to do so.
Right. And I think that if anything, and you know, I would love to talk with somebody from GOG to find out how much this actually influences things, but my personal sense is by being involved in this kind of self-curated game collecting scene, online game collecting scene, I really feel that a lot of the people involved in this were the people who, when GOG launched or when GOG was being announced, were the first people to run to GOG and say, hey, thank you for letting me buy this. You know, I've had to keep this, you know, running on my abandonware site for the last 5 years. I'm happy to take down my link now and link to you.
No, absolutely.
You know, I really get the feeling, I'll come out and say this, I really agree with somebody like Jason Scott.
Yeah.
Who says straight up, go ahead, pirate this stuff, keep it archived, you know, please keep a copy somewhere, because you know, his feeling is you do it first, you ask permission later, because otherwise we would have lost a lot
we
of stuff in the last
such
years. And we have
insane flow of information now where everything becomes obsolete very, very quickly. And when it comes to something that we particularly like as a you know, well, games, a game, some games are this, some games are that, but sometimes it's art, sometimes it's shit. It doesn't really matter. Because this is this is a history of the medium that we admire greatly, so it's important for us to sort of hold on to its history. It's a rather brief history, but yet brief, yet very very quickly disappearing.
Absolutely, and in a very intense history too. I mean, how many games were released in between 1980 and 1989 that nobody knows about anymore?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and one thing that it concerns me, and maybe this is getting a little off topic, but I think it's kind of related to, especially to piracy, is one thing I've begun to learn is that, you know, the popular games have written the history books, the Sierra games, the LucasArts games, and me and Ben 304 have talked about this several times. The downfall or the downside of that has been that the games that were not that popular yet were really, really important, or were, you know what, were just shitty games, but they were made by one person at one time in their life. Those games have disappeared off into oblivion, and they don't really play a role in the way the history is told now about the history of gaming. And that's really sad.
Yes.
You know, because those are games we all grew up with. They may have been crappy games. Was it with you I was talking about that horrific software company called Pie in the Sky Software?
Yeah, yes, that was me. I love them. Well, it's not their company is not horrific. Horrific what most people did with their product.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah,
they didn't do it. It was a kit. I love that kit. I still have at least three copies of it, all different versions.
Yes, I should have. I apologize. It was definitely
like
just
I have the DOS kit, version. I have the early Windows version. I even had the Direct 3D version, one of the latest ones. So yeah,
wow.
Pi 3D GSK. No, yes, GC,
exactly.
GCES. No, GC, I guess, Game Construction Kit.
Game
Fuck
construction.
Me, what yeah, a fucking right. name.
Those are the kinds of things that are not.
And by the way, yeah, it's actually a good idea, because I've seen this one of the sites that I will not name recently.
Okay.
Put up at least a couple of versions of Pi, and actually one of the message boards, they've been adding Pi in the Sky 3D games
lately.
Awesome. Because one guy on the message board tries to get them all.
Oh,
so,
cool.
As that's, shitty that's as they are, and it's a game that's like not 90% of them are shit, 105% of them are shit.
Yes, they define what the word shit
very
means.
Much like shitty first-person shooter. Well, actually, no, I have say that I have played worse commercial first-person shooters than the ones that I've seen that were made in Pi in the Sky 3D, which is really sad. But I'd say yes, but it's still important to preserve those games so we can look back at them and never repeat that mistake ever again. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think it's important that, again, I'm very much personally against this idea that LucasArts or Sierra or any of those huge companies from the past get the kind of exclusive right to define the history of gaming, because all of us played the crappy games because they were there, and you know, whether we like them or not, they're kind of a definitive part of, you know, how we grew up or how we know not to make those same mistakes now in games. And I think of, for instance, a lot of those crappy educational titles that came out during the big rush to edutainment in the 90s. Yeah, and those are hard to find. I mean,
very hard to find. A lot of them fall into that made with Macromedia Director category
exactly.
that I love a lot. But some of them actually are really, really good and completely unknown. Like,
exactly.
Especially early ones, like the Win16 ones, the ones from Windows 3.1.
That was the one I was just going to say.
None of them almost exist anymore. Like, even physically, and you will never be able to find, like, an ISO online. Like, you may be lucky if you find somebody, like, someone arcaded for, like, Mac or something.
It's exactly.
But yeah, like, most of those disappeared, and thank God for some other unmentionable resources that have started collecting those things recently, which I'm very happy, because most of those games are some of them are so amazing, because almost none of them are done by people who knew what the fuck they were doing. So they would try,
yeah,
and they were just like throwing shit against the wall. Like, it's like.
Exactly. They were
some
blending
are really,
genres that
really
together.
Artistic, some of them not even games, others just bizarre. And they all were like made with by people who couldn't program and stuff like that. But it's like, hey, with Macromedia Director, you didn't have to. So like people were just like, got like three, most people who did those projects got like what they got? Photoshop, 3D Studio Max, and QuickTime, and Director. And it was like the factory. Like,
yeah. And you had one or two people making this entire
Or like,
product.
Like
no
one
idea.
Or two people and like 10 artists. Would come in and it's like all kinds of different art just thrown together in one game. Amazing things. Those things are lost. They're not even like they're on the brink of extinction. And that's why we need piracy, really. Like that's the easiest way for me to defend piracy when it comes to old games. Because especially for a person who appreciates old gaming and like stuff is in foreign stuff, like I've been going through some Korean stuff lately. And it's really interesting, very intriguing, very different. A lot of it is very, very different. And stuff like that, I would never, like, I don't know those titles. I still don't understand what those titles are. I can barely play most of them. So there would be no way in hell I would come across them in, like, day-to-day life. So
exactly.
And here it pops up on some release on some abandonware site. I see it. I see screenshots. And I'm like, wow, that looks cool. Let me try this out. And just like with everything else I pirated in my life, who knows, one day I might actually own, you know, a physical copy of it. Because, like...
Yeah, and...
That's never been an issue. So like I always, people are like, oh, you probably just pirate everything. Like, I buy stuff. I pay for my,
yeah,
I like
me too.
Paying for my stuff with my hard earned cash. But if it wasn't for piracy, I probably would not have, well, not probably, especially when it comes to DOS games, considering where I grew up. If it wasn't for piracy, I would not have been here right now doing this.
Me too.
And I would not have played like 95% of all the titles that I have played.
Well, you know, and that's a really good point. Because I'm starting to realize back, at least in the early 2000s, piracy, or at least abandonware, the whole idea of going to Home of the Underdogs or something, was that I could check their top dog lists. I think it was called Top Dog.
I think so.
Yeah, and I could see these games I had never even heard of. You know, like Albion, or, you know, all of these great kind of FPS slash adventure titles, which
everything.
I would have
they
never
had also
across.
You know what, actually what they had for the longest time as well, Cosmology of Kyoto, which is like another
a
game that's amazing. Like it's so different. It's foreign and amazing, it covers both grounds. But yeah, like those
exactly
together with Dark Eye, like, and other stuff like this, like that was I don't know, that was the only place to get those sort of things. Incredibly interesting.
And a great way to, you know, unfortunately it didn't become that, but it would have been a great way to market these games, you know, and keep them out in circulation.
Right.
You know, because I find it very silly, you know, that, for instance, I get that books go out of circulation because you don't want to have a printing machine printing the same book for 25 years, but,
right,
you know, games don't really have that excuse. I mean, other than, you know, they can just say, well, we don't provide support for this game. Cool. Well, that's fine. Still, you know, why aren't these companies selling them? I would love to play.
Yeah, it seems,
you know,
very
90%
unfortunate
of the stuff,
especially with services like GOG, like companies that are still reluctant to share their intellectual property, even with a company like GOG, at least from what I understand it now, it's like, you know, they just push it out to them and they struggle to like make it a presentable
release.
Make
it work. Yeah.
So it's really onto them, and it's like, it would make sense financially, would benefit all the parties, but
that's right.
So, you know, it's not the case like this. You know, sometimes, like, we, especially in the last decade or so, we've been shown that companies are just are more likely to just hold on very tightly to their IPs and not let go, and like lock them away somewhere far, far away in hopes of one day maybe reaching back into this vault of I don't know what, and I don't know for what, to make a, like, I don't know, like to turn a strategy game into a first person shooter all of a sudden, stuff like that. It's really weird.
Exactly. And I think that is part of the attitude, is like, you know, we plan to, or we maybe someday will use this IP for something, and we don't want players to find out that this game was originally an adventure or this was an RPG. And I think that's just such a backwards way of promoting, you know, your own products.
Well, that's why companies are shit and you should pirate everything. You heard it here first, kids. So yeah, so like I'm very grateful for services like GOG and Dotemu and whatever other future services will start to you know, like, sort of shake down publishers for their old IPs, so maybe one day we can enjoy. Or you know what, like, you know, if new release comes and sometimes I guess companies can throw in an old release with a new release, sort of kind of thing, you know, like like Doom, original Doom was included in Doom 3 BFG. And I also appreciate that, those sort of things. Or maybe if it's like a remake, like Monkey Island Special Edition, which is not very good. But at least
terrible,
terrible fucking everything. Oh no, let's not fucking go into this now. You can tell me, dear listeners, you can tell me how great the Monkey Island Special Edition is in comments. I'd
Please
love to hear
me
it.
Wrong. Prove me.
But at least you have that nifty feature where you can switch into at least CD VGA version, which is also far from perfect, but at least better than the one that, you know, and, you know, there's a couple LucasArts games on Steam and stuff like this. So, like, I do appreciate at least some kind of, you know, like, offering, retro offering with the new package. So it's, I appreciate when companies do this, and I surely love companies like GOG. But when all else fails, I go to my last option, which is, I don't know, Google a download. So.
Yeah. And I'm personally, you know, I have nothing but good things to say about GOG, because I spent a lot of money at GOG.
Oh, yes.
And, one of the things I appreciate is I'm older, I'm busier, I don't have time to dick around with my DOSBox configuration files or trying to patch up a game that is ages old now, you know, trying to run the DOS version of Fallout on my Mac through DOSBox is a nightmare. I really appreciate that GOG actually puts a lot of work into the releases and making sure that they run on, you know, multi-platform for some of them.
Right.
And that's, you know, the fact that it saves me time is that's why I'm willing to shell out $2 or $5 or $10.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree. So I guess our topic in the end came to just piracy. So this is, which is okay.
I want to assure those poor developers that I pirated your games almost without exception.
We love you. Yeah.
Exactly. And I almost bought all of your games, and the only person I really screwed over was Jeff Tunnel, because I never could find a legal copy of the Incredible Machine. I'm so sorry, Dynamics. I've spent 20 years collecting everything I've loved, everything I can find. I rebuy it on GOG if I can to support those people. If they ever had, like Richard Garriott did, a pirate amnesty where I can throw $5 or $10 their way to make up the fact that I pirated their games as kids, I'm so happy to, because your games are amazing, and that's why I'm a developer these days.
Okay, well, there it is, you know, our episode on piracy. Chris, it's been a pleasure to have you on this show, and maybe one day you can come back and we'll talk about maybe something else.
Absolutely.
Maybe something legal for a change.
I'd love to. This has been a real pleasure for me, Anatoly, and hopefully I will talk to you soon.
Well, before we part, how about telling our listeners where they can find you on the World Wide Web?
Yes, you can always find me at Artful Gamer on Twitter. That is @ArtfulGamer. Really happy to chat with you about old games or new games. Or if you want to, you can read my old website, which I used to write about games as a games writer/blogger for about almost 10 years, at www.artfulgamer.com.
Fabulous. And you can find me at Das Nostalgic on Twitter, or anywhere where you can search for Das Nostalgia will take you. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for listening. It's been a pleasure as always, and hopefully we'll meet once again on this Das Nostalgia podcast. Goodbye.